Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
On election day, you never know what can happen. Even in a thoroughly red state like Utah, where there was a pretty strong sense of inevitability, the idea of possibility can drive people to vote. Most Utahns voted early. They mailed in their ballots and settled in to see what will happen. But there are still plenty of people who went out and voted yesterday. KUER's David Kondos talked to some of them in the St. George area. And if you listen closely here, you can probably hear some clues about issues and ideas that fueled the outcome of the election of 2024.
All right. Well, ready to head out. Going to go to the one polling place here in St. George. Going to ask voters what's on their minds and see what I get.
Hi, I'm a local reporter just getting people's thoughts.
There you go.
Are you up for sharing?
No, I'm good. Thank you, though.
Have a good day. Hi, I'm a local reporter gathering people's thoughts about voting. No interest. All right, have a good day.
A lot of people here. I was a little bit worried. More than half of voters have already cast their ballot early or through the mail, but there is a good stream of people here.
So you just voted for the first time?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was a little overwhelming, and it really felt like I was doing something, so it's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Any particular issues that were on your mind or most important to you as you're deciding how you're out to vote?
The biggest thing, so I'm a criminal justice major, right? So making sure we have good judges is up my alley.
I wish we had a better choice of candidates from both parties. I just feel like we've got crazy and crazier, so.
I'm really happy I did something. It's awesome.
You know, people are mainly focused on higher government, right? And I'm more focused on local government, because that's where it starts, is the local government.
350 million people that live in our country, this is the best we can come up with. So yeah, I'm kind of disgusted by what I feel like.
Man, still cars keep coming in. It's just a steady stream of cars. It has not stopped the whole time I've been here. Just cars coming in all morning.
Hi, I'm a local reporter gathering people's thoughts. Not interested.
Yeah, I voted already.
You got your sticker.
It's already done.
All right, so what was some of the big issues? What was on your mind?
One of the bigger ones for me this year was probably like inflation, the economy. We've been dealing with a lot of hard times. I'm a full-time student, so making my way this last year that I've been a student for has been pretty tough.
The economy is the number one problem. I think if the economy was stable, everything else may fall into place.
The border down south is a big one for me, too. I'm all for, you know, the American dream, but I think there should be a certain level of legality to it.
Well, thanks for your time.
Thank
Have a good
you.
Day. Well, thanks for your time.
Thank
man.
You.
I appreciate it.
All right, well, talked with lots of voters. Well, when I was on my way driving over here, I was a little unsure of whether or not there would be that many people, period, because of all the mail-in voting, but there are. So, yeah, people are excited to vote, excited to be here in person, despite traffic or construction or long lines or, anything else going on. They really want to be here. So, yeah, it's all in their hands now, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens here and around the state and across the country.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, and now we know what happened, of course. Donald Trump won a convincing victory for president yesterday. It can be said his party did, too. Republicans will take control of the Senate as well as the White House, and while it's too early to say, they'll probably take the House as well. Here in Utah, Republicans also swept the field, at least in the major races, governor, senator, attorney general, all of the congressional seats. So today on the program, we are going to talk about the election, not just what happened, maybe also why and what happens now. A lot of the candidates who won yesterday are relatively new to the process, many of them anyway. So we'll see if we can get a sense of the themes or the direction for the political landscape of Utah. Joining us here live in the studio is Sean Higgins. He is KUER's politics and government reporter, co-host of State Street. Sean, welcome back to you.
Good morning.
Sage Miller, she, of course, co-hosts State Street along with Sean Higgins. She is a politics and government reporter for KUER. Sage Miller, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And we have Robert Gerke here in the studio also. He's a columnist, of course, a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Robert Gerke, welcome to you.
Good morning.
And we have David Magleby back with us, though not here in the studio. He's a professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University. And David Magleby, welcome back to you.
Good to be with you all.
Okay. Well, where to begin? I guess, Robert Gerke, let me have you just start. We'll dig into some details as we go, but generally speaking, reaction to what happened?
Locally speaking, it was pretty much by the book, I think. No real surprises. The Republicans, as you mentioned, went up and down the major races. Governor Cox, Derrick Brown won the attorney general's race. Most of the margins were about what we thought they would be. They're traditionally about 2-1, and this was no exception. The governor's race, obviously, we had that wrinkle thrown in with Phil Lyman's write-in campaign. Phil, last I looked, was sitting at about 9% of the vote, which for a write-in candidate is pretty solid. But, you know, write-in campaigns are sort of, you know, fighting, tilting at windmills, right? So it was not something that I think was going to work out for him. Despite that 9% that he siphoned off of Governor Cox, he still won comfortably. So I don't think there were a lot of surprises. One of the things that I thought was kind of interesting, at least, is we talked on the show before about Amendment D, the potential fallout for the legislature trying to repeal that ballot initiative ruling by the Supreme Court, and the backlash or the outrage that voters had, was that going to show up in the ballot box? And, Sage and Sean can provide their input. I don't see it right now, just based on the results that we saw. It looks like only one legislative seat flipped from Republican to Democrat. And it was a seat that was an open seat anyway. It wasn't a Republican candidate who had voted for that. So no real backlash or repercussions from that from my vantage point.
Sean Higgins, one of the things you mentioned is you were maybe going to pay more attention to the margins than you were the outcome, because the outcome seemed like we could probably predict. What did you notice there?
I think taking at a glance at a snapshot at the state view, like Robert said, it was fairly predictable. The margins were consistent with what they have been in the past. With some things that stuck out to me, Robert, you talked about the write-in campaign of Phil Lyman that obviously had a lot of traction on social media and in certain spheres of Republican politics here in Utah. That seems to be, even though 10% is still good for a write-in candidate, more of a whimper than a roar from the far right of the Utah Republican Party supporting Phil Lyman. What really stuck out to me in these statewide races was how poorly third-party candidates did. There were a lot of people talking about Michelle Quist's candidacy for attorney general, possibly siphoning away a good amount of votes from a more establishment Republican, Derrick Brown, who's been involved in GOP politics for years and years here in Utah. Last I checked, she's under 10% right now, well behind the Democratic candidate. And there's no doubt that Derrick Brown will be the next attorney general of Utah. So I think looking broadly, things went as we thought they would, but there were some really interesting, more local and kind of subsurface trends that were piquing my interest. But as a whole, this was kind of a by-the-book election, at least in Utah.
Sage, before we get to David Magley, what did you notice? What were you noticing?
I agree with both Sean and Gerke that it kind of was the turnout that we expected. I mean, I do think that in some areas where in 2020 or 2022, Democrats maybe had a little bit of a leg or they were close in races with Republicans. That's kind of gone. We see that Donald Trump's support in Utah has actually gone up from 2020, not significantly, about a point.
Yeah, less than a percentage point.
Yeah, less than a percentage point, but we still have more votes coming in.
But it's holding.
Yeah, but it's holding his support. And we also saw that when you look at Democratic candidate Brian King, who was running for governor, he's around 30%, which is pretty consistent with what governor candidates, the Democratic candidate, has done. So we didn't really see the needle moving there. It's not that we expected Phil Lyman to siphon off any votes and go for the Democrats, but I think it also shows that maybe perhaps it was a silent minority of the people who were former Republicans or disenfranchised Republicans that didn't want to vote for Cox after his endorsement of the former president. And then, yeah, like that one House, there was some talk that Democrats could actually be pretty competitive in the state legislature seats when it comes to Salt Lake County. We're not seeing that play out. As of right now, we're seeing the tight races that were in 2020 and 2022, Democrats actually tailing behind more so than that. So the margins are, I think, predictable. They're on par, but also maybe, I mean, I think that Democrats maybe probably underperformed a little bit. I know they still don't agree with me.
we can get into that. Yeah. I think you're right. I think they did underperform.
Yeah, let's come back to that. I want to hear from David Magleby first, just your general and larger impressions. David Magleby.
Well, I think, as the others have said, it was a Republican affair. And the takeaways for me, and the margins were, I think, predictable. Lyman, as has been said, was a non-factor despite all of his protestations and lawsuits. But I think one of the takeaways is it reinforces the importance of gerrymandering. Because had the districts been drawn differently or more in line with what the redistricting commission recommended, the Democrats probably would have won congressional victory out of Salt Lake County. And so structure matters, and the Republican redistricting plan paid off for them both in Utah and nationally.
Okay. One thing I was noticing when you're talking about margins, Sean Higgins, you mentioned you were paying attention to margins. I guess we all were. And when you look at the statewide races and the congressional races, it was pretty much 60-30 Republican-Dem. 60-30. The kind of outlier, although not by much, was Spencer Cox, because there was that Phil Lyman part that played in there. And it made me wonder, does this tell us something about straight party ticket votings? Does this tell us something about the fact that it's just – that is just the trend, that when you're looking at when voters consider – condition of the country, the economy, those basic kinds of principles, they just went for Republicans. What does that all say to you, Sean?
I think it says something to just the demographic makeup of Utah. Sage and I spoke with former Congressman Ben McAdams for an episode of State Street about his strategies when he was running as a Democrat in some of these really competitive races. He's, for people who are unfamiliar with who Ben McAdams is, he's the last Democrat to hold a federal office in Utah. He was the representative for the 4th Congressional District from 2019 to 2021. And he really said, the Republicans are in a position where how they run a race is actually pretty straightforward. They just have to make it about the Republican versus the Democrat. For Democrats to gain momentum, they need to separate themselves from national politics and make it about me, the candidate, versus the Republican, versus as opposed to me, the Democrat, versus the Republican. And I think that makes it incredibly hard for at least looking at it at a statewide level. Makes that really hard to draw a distinction and get through the partisan gridlock and the partisan polarization that we're in, not just in Utah but nationally.
Does that put more onus on – and we can, I think, come back to this because the question is whether or not Democrats in this state moved the needle. It doesn't seem like hardly at all. So does this put the onus on Democrats – in this state to kind of, to your point, Sean, be more creative about messaging, about candidate selection, or are they just sort of set in stone for the moment. Robert Gerke, what do you think?
I mean, I think party identification is a huge driver in politics. I think David can probably back that up with the actual political science on it. But you look at a race like the state treasurer race that probably not a ton of people paid attention to. Neil Hansen didn't spend much money as the Democratic nominee running for it. He got 31%. And then you look at what Brian King got. He got 31% and spent close to $800,000, is an established political figure in the state, and ran a campaign but didn't move the needle even a little bit. And then Rudy Bautista spent $160 of his own money on his campaign.
Didn't even identify as a Democrat in the debate.
That's right. Yeah.
4 years ago, he ran as the Libertarian, and he got 29%. So you're just looking at this entrenched partisanship, I think, that it makes it incredibly difficult to move the needle, particularly in the Democrats' case in many of these races where they didn't get quality candidates. The Attorney General race in particular is one that people I've talked to in the Democratic Party and in the legal community thought, well, after Sean Reyes's latest, scandal in office, three in a row now, we've had three attorneys general in a row who've had this happen to them. This is an opportunity for Democrats to make some hay, right? They didn't get a quality candidate who didn't spend money, who didn't campaign, didn't help the party, and you see the results that
$160 versus $1 million, I think, in spending.
Yeah, 1.2, yeah, from Derek Brown. So the hill that they're trying to climb is daunting, and it's hard to recruit candidates when you're looking at that unlikely outcome, or maybe the likely loss. But it just kind of goes to show that regardless of who you get to run, I mean, again, Brian King was a good candidate and a fairly well-known candidate with some fundraising prowess, but it was not enough to break free from these sort of these partisan identifications that are just set in cement.
David Magleby, it seems like when, again, looking at the numbers here, 34%, 32%, 31%, 30%, they're all in that 30% range. What is that telling you, David Magleby?
As has been said, it's an era of partisan polarization, much less split-ticket voting than was true 20 years ago or even 15 years ago. And Utah's not alone. That's a national trend. And as has been said, that severely limits candidate recruitment for the Democrats going forward. If you're thinking about running and investing the time and effort in a race and some of your own resources, why would you do it? And I think it becomes a very hard sell for Democrats in Utah.
If I could just add, that was one of the reasons I thought this independent phenomenon that we were seeing this year was worth watching. Because Evan McMullen ended up losing his Senate race 2 years ago to Mike Lee, but he got 45%. Caroline Gleick got 32%. So the independent, once you strip away that partisan identification, maybe there's a way to break through. But as we saw with all of these independent candidates or unaffiliated candidates who are running this year, they did not perform. I mean, Evan McMullen obviously had a bigger name ID, had raised a lot of money for that Senate race. So maybe that's a different animal. But yeah, the independent, the unaffiliated candidates who are running for legislative seats, for example, didn't make much of an impact.
And part of that, I think, is really it is candidate recruitment, right? So if I'm looking at State House 30, which was the open seat that flipped Dem, that's Jake Fitisimanu. And he is a two-term city councilor in West Valley City. I went out canvassing with him. I thought it was going to be a story. It didn't turn out to be a story. But I went out canvassing with him, knocking on doors.
A tale as old as time as a reporter.
I think there's something there. Yeah,
tell your editor, I believe in me. I know this is a story. Yeah. Let me do this.
I was behind on the story.
Wait, it wasn't a story. Why wasn't it a story?
Because I was going out canvassing, trying to figure out what was on the minds of voters on the final days of the election. But canvassing at that point is just like, hey, did you turn in your ballot? So I was like, oh, yeah, this isn't a story. But I did go out door knocking, like following him around a little bit. And the fact every door this man knocked on, the people behind the door knew him by name, and he knew them on a first name basis. He speaks Samoan, Portuguese, Spanish, and English, which is very needed for that district as it's very culturally diverse and a lot of people, English is not their first language. And so he was a great candidate that Democrats put up, and it turned out to be fruitful, but like not everybody's going to be a Jake Fitisimanu. So I think that he felt like he was a good candidate. People in his district, we knocked on doors where people were like, I voted for Trump, but I voted for you, Jake, and he's a Democrat. So it's like, I do think that there needs to be some candidate recruitment. And I did talk to Elevate Strategies, which is a Democratic, it's a left-leaning political consulting firm here in Utah that started about 2 years ago. And one of the co-founders, Gabby Finlayson, was saying like, yeah, it's really hard to try and convince good Democratic candidates to want to put in the work when they have a feeling they're – or history would show they're most likely not going to be successful in winning that seat. So they got a lot of work to do. And I think they were feeling a little more hopeful with the results and not necessarily saying that they were going to win, but at least the margins would be different. And this is just kind of essentially showing the status quo. So I bet you they're going to go back to the drawing board, maybe go a little bit harder in 2026 when the midterms are up, and also probably cross their fingers that a lower court judge tells them to redraw the congressional maps.
Sage Miller. She's KUER's politics and government reporter. She co-hosts State Street along with Sean Higgins, who's also with us, politics and government reporter for KUER. David Magleby, professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University, is with us along with Robert Gerke. He is a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We need to take a break, but we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened in the 2024 election here in Utah. And by now, you know the basics. A big win for Republicans across the country, certainly here in Utah, where the GOP yet again swept the major statewide races. We're also talking about the margins and the outcomes and whether Utah Democrats managed to move the needle at all in the state. We have with us David Magleby, a professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University. Also, Sage Miller and Sean Higgins, their political reporters for KUER. They co-host the podcast State Street, and Robert Gerke is a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. So what are you seeing in the congressional races beyond the fact that Republicans swept that? There are some new faces. There are some so I'm wondering, what do you think, as it seems the Republicans are poised to keep the House and take the Senate, what are you expecting in the way of politics, rhetoric from Utah's congressional delegation, and how might that impact the state? I'm thinking of federal land. I'm thinking about energy. I'm thinking about all of those kinds of things. How are you all thinking about that? Sean Higgins, you want to take that?
Speaking to the new name, former State Senator Mike Kennedy will be the new representative for the 3rd Congressional District, which is John Curtis's current, soon-to-be former seat. And he has really been I wouldn't say he's been an outspoken member of the legislature, but he has run some very controversial bills. He's the sponsor of the ban on gender-affirming care for minors bill that was passed a couple of years ago. And he's not necessarily a firebrand, but when he's pushed, he will push back quite hard. Even against members of his own party, as we've seen over the last few years on the floor of the Senate here in Utah. As far as rhetoric on the national scene, the representative that stands out to me as who's been the most outspoken has been Burgess Owens. He's really been an unabashed America First MAGA Republican and has spoken very openly on the campaign trail over the last few years about his desire to support that agenda. And that has not changed for me. After last night, he spoke at the GOP watch party in Draper last night where I was there, and it was just kind of more of the same. And so I think politicians like Owens will be a little more emboldened to propose policies that are in line with that agenda. Mike Kennedy's actions at the state legislature lead me to believe he would at least be supportive of those actions, if not vocally voicing those. I think Celeste Malloy in the 2nd District and Blake Moore in the 1st District have been a little more in the background, but Blake Moore has been slowly rising in the hierarchy of Republican politics.
He's on Ways and Means. He's on the Budget Committee. He's the vice chair of the House Republican. He seems to be a
– Yeah, so I think
he's climbing.
Very much kind of following in the footsteps of someone like former Congressman Chris Stewart, who was kind of a low-key guy but was widely respected in Congress in the things that I've heard about him. And
why is he rising? Is he the kind of – it doesn't seem like the kind of firebrand like Burgess.
No,
he's not a firebrand.
He's so not at all.
So incredibly pragmatic.
Yeah, I mean he talks about wanting to reverse Washington's debt culture, which you don't hear from a lot of Republicans these days, and it's interesting that he's on the move. What do you make of that?
I think that they just want Utah to have more of a national voice. I think it's fallen to the wayside. They call it a flyover state when it comes to politics. And so they just kind of want to change that brand and show that they are a pretty strong state. You see Blake Moore talk about how Washington needs to be more like Utah, especially when it comes to the budget, because Utah every year has a balanced budget. And so he says, well, I can take that. And I, as a guy who can work across the aisle, who has worked on bipartisan legislation, but who is also very loyal to my party, he had good relationships with former Speaker, oh my gosh, it's Kevin McCarthy. There we go. Kevin McCarthy. And he has good relationships with the current House Speaker, Mike Johnson. So he's making more friends than probably enemies. And so I think that he's going to continue to fly under the radar. He hasn't come out and speak out much. He's not necessarily a firebrand. And I think the one that you hear the most firebrand, yeah, is Burgess Owens. But what does this mean in the grand scheme of things for Utahns? I just think that it's going to be easier for Republicans to pass certain agendas.
Well, yeah, I want to ask about that. And David Magleby, I want to get you in on this, because the question of extraction on public lands, I want to hear all of you on this, but what do you make of that? There is that question. Utah is one of, if not the, has the most public land in the state. What does a Trump presidency, a Republican House probably, and Republican Senate, what does that mean, do you think, for Utah land? I guess you've been thinking about that a bit.
It makes a big difference. If the Republicans stay in the majority, if they don't, then Utah will be in the wilderness politically, because it'll be a Democratic House and no Democrats in the Utah delegation. So with respect to the public lands, Trump has been clear that he wants to drill, baby, drill. And I think he will also want to expand mining. And so we're going to go back to some of his policies when he was in office. And I think it has real implications, even if the idea of the sale of some public land, which has been floated, doesn't go forward. The existing public land, I think, will be repurposed to the Trump agenda.
My first thought when it comes to the public lands issues in particular is we'll see the monuments shrink again, right? That's something Trump did during his first term. Biden administration undid it. He can redo that with a stroke of a pen, and we'll undo that. Yeah, extraction is going to be a big issue. He mentioned coal last night in his acceptance speech, which doesn't always happen in acceptance speeches. Beyond that, I mean, there's a whole host of things that are going to impact Utahns. The energy production thing you mentioned, the student loan debt forgiveness. So a lot of the students up here at the university are probably aware at least that the Biden administration had pushed for forgiveness, had been tied up in courts, and you can expect that will go away. Things like I'm curious to see how this mass deportations goes. Remember that Trump has promised, he's going to have the largest deportations, and we had this back in the 50s during the Eisenhower administration, and it drew some blowback, but the specifics, how he wants to do that, because he said it's anywhere from 2 to 20 million people, depending on who he's talking to at the time. That's a huge logistical problem. It impacts our, workforce. It impacts all sorts of things, and it impacts families, Utah families, among others. So the House delegation, Mike Kennedy, as the new member, is probably not going to have much impact on anything. He's of one vote, really, and otherwise, is going to spend the first 2 years trying to figure out where the bathrooms are. But Blake Moore being in leadership, I think he's shown that he can sort of straddle this line between the Freedom Caucus and the more mainstream Republicans. He can speak to both and has credibility in both. So he's going to be at the table where the decisions are made. So that's potentially good for Utah, and it's going to be worth watching. I guess the other thing impact that I'm watching for is who is going to have a spot in the administration. There's been talk about Mike Lee becoming Donald Trump's attorney general, and that's a pretty important position given some of the things that President-elect Trump has said about using the Justice Department to crack down on his enemies. You know, Mike Lee would be the hatchet man, so to speak, if he gets that position and is able to be confirmed by his Senate colleagues with a Republican Senate. That's probably a little bit easier than it otherwise would be. Sean Reyes is another name that's been mentioned as a potential having a potential spot in the administration. So there's a lot of wheels in motion that are going to impact this state in a pretty big way, I think.
David Magleby, would Mike Lee be attorney general until there's an opening in the Supreme Court? He has been on his short list, Donald Trump's short list. Not sure if you can anticipate much of that, but it seems like Mike Lee is going to play an important role in the Trump administration.
Yes, and he's been visible in those ways in the national media. The Atlantic had a feature article on him that touted his possible appointment to the Justice Department or to the Supreme Court. I think that's on his horizon here. And as Robert just mentioned, I think the chances of confirmation have gone up substantially. There used to be a norm called senatorial courtesy, which said that if a senator is nominated for something out of courtesy, other senators would get in line. I think that courtesy is less the case now. But I think he could easily become part of a new Trump administration.
What do we know about turnout? I know it's probably too early to be able to parse the particulars here, but there were questions about younger voters, the gender gap, Democratic women and playing a role. Robert, one of the things you mentioned, Democratic women seem to be turning out in numbers a lot higher than they did 2 or 4 years ago. The Dobbs decision is driving a lot of that clearly. What can we say about the particular demographic points in Utah at this point? Anything?
Yeah, we're going to have to sort of parse that a little bit more. As of yesterday, the early voting, it did show that, you know, based on modeling that was done by a Democratic consulting firm, but based on that modeling, Democratic women, particularly Democratic women over 65, had turned out at a higher level. They were making up a larger percentage of the electorate than they had before. We don't know if that held up on Election Day because we saw really high Election Day turnout. So those numbers we're going to have to go through as we get some exit polling data and so forth. But the Democrats nationally had pinned a lot of their hopes on high, you know, turnout among women and among young women in particular. And they seem to have gotten that in many respects, but nationally at least, we also saw them losing 18 percentage points among Latino men, which is something that they're going to have to sit down and do a long postmortem look at, I think, because you rarely see demographic groups swing the way that Latino men have swung in the last two elections. And it poses a real threat to the future viability of the Democratic Party, frankly.
What about young men? What do we know about that? There was the big question of whether they would turn out. In your reporting, Sage and Sean, did you sense anything about that and whether or not they actually went and voted yesterday? I guess we don't know yet, but what do you make of that?
I will say just anecdotally, at the GOP watch party last night, there were a lot of young men there. A lot of young men there. I didn't do a head count, but it felt like almost a majority of the people there looked like men under 40. I think
this was a big target.
This was a huge target for Republicans. And I think there's a lot to be said about, people talk about these pivotal moments that happen in your beginnings of your career as someone who's been involved in politics. People talk about Gen X growing up with Ronald Reagan. A lot of millennials grew up with the Obama years. Yes, Gen Z grew up with Trump, but I think when you break it down, men versus women, we had the Me Too movement in the late 2010s, the big social justice push after George Floyd's murder, and the common narrative, at least on the Democratic side, was frankly a lot of vilifying of men and white men in particular. And I think when you have young, impressionable minds and a lot of people either explicitly or implicitly saying that the world is bad because of people like you, they're going to be looking for a refuge somewhere. And I think the Republicans saw that and ran hard in that direction. And it seems to have paid off, at least nationally.
David Megley, what did you notice? Have you noticed about demographics and numbers and gender gap and those kinds of things? Too early to say anything definitive, I'm guessing, but comments on that so far? Early.
But I would say that there's some evidence of a confirmation of the Trump strategy. And to that extent, the J.D. Vance inclusion as the vice presidential candidate, I believe part of his selection was to try and solidify this move towards young male voters. And, you know, we can point to some of the things that Vance said that may well have reinforced that. The other thing I would say about turnout is Utah initially was very supportive of vote by mail long before COVID. It was a move of necessity given the cost of upgrading voting machines. Very popular with voters across the parties. But Trump came along and denigrated it. And as a result, people thought they really needed to vote in person. And we saw some of that, I think, yesterday. I think there was a Trump effect in the high election day vote turnout in several counties. But it's most evident in Utah County and to some extent, Washington County. And here we had, I think, election administration incompetence, where Utah County, at the county clerk's office, ran out of ballots. And then they had problems with printers running out of ink and so forth and so on. Moreover, that county clerk made a big deal out of saving money by saying on the return envelope for the vote-by-mail ballot that you had to put postage when, in fact, it is not required. So I think there's going to be some re-examination, at least I hope there will be, of election administration in places like Utah, Cache, Washington counties. Voters were in line for 2 hours, apparently, in Weber County yesterday. That's much too long.
Yeah, just before we move on there, it's hard to overstate the incompetence of the Utah County Clerk this election. I mean, the fact that they ran out of paper, they loaded up the state plane and were flying to Arizona to get paper to cut to make ballots because they didn't order enough ballots. Then when they started printing ballots, they ran out of ink. You know, the lieutenant governor said last night it was a failure on the part of one county to plan appropriately. And none of this is a surprise. We've run elections before. We know how this works. We know how many people are going to vote. And he was caught completely unprepared. I mean, the county commissioner, Amelia Powers Gardner, who was the former county clerk and actually brought in some good election changes down in that what is consistently one of the worst run elections in the state. She said maybe if he spent more time preparing for the election and doing predictive modeling instead of playing politics with Phil Lyman, he could have been prepared for our citizens. I mean, people are upset about this, and there's going to be a lot of scrutiny on what he did because, as David mentioned, he discouraged people from voting early. He wanted people to vote in person, but then he didn't have enough polling locations open. They ran out of ballots. It was a fiasco from the start to finish. And again, I think this is maybe what happens when you have a clerk who's driven by politics and not by performance.
And that clerk's office in general has kind of been a rotating door over the last handful of years. I am blanking on the top of my head how many county clerks they've had, but they've rotated through a number of them.
Yeah, Brian was the county clerk there for a long time, and they consistently had problems down mm-hmm. there. And when Amelia came in, she kind of righted the ship a little bit, but Aaron's taken him back in that direction. And I just also, you know, I also want to mention this is on top of him potentially violating the law by singling out specific ballots that have been cast by state legislators, which, you know, we're supposed to have a secret ballot in this country and in this state. And so there's a lot of outrage over that as well.
Additionally, I want to give massive kudos to Courtney Tanner with the Salt Lake Tribune for following that story. But also Aaron Davidson essentially asked the legislature to reconsider same-day voter registration at the polls because it puts a lot of stress on what county clerks do. So he did kind of blame the legislature for allowing same-day voting, which caused this fiasco.
Sage Miller. She's KUER's politics and government reporter. She co-hosts State Street along with Sean Higgins. He's also with us. David Magleby, professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University, is with us along with Robert Gerke. He is a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take one more break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about the election today with our group of experts. We have Sean Higgins, KUER's politics and government reporter, Sage Miller. She's also politics and government reporter for KUER. They co-host the podcast State Street. We have David Magleby of Brigham Young University. He's a professor emeritus of political science there. And Robert Gerke, of course, with the Salt Lake Tribune. I want to ask a little bit about judges. Who pays attention to judges during the election? It seems like there was a lot of it. Sean, you go first. Seems like people were actually paying attention to the judges this time.
Yeah. I saw Fox 13 political reporter Ben Winslow said the Utah Supreme Court had a brat summer. With all of their rulings on cases with redistricting and abortion. And in some political circles, there was some blowback there. We certainly, at least in the state house, there are rumblings of potentially looking at how the judicial system is confirmed and retained. They want to prevent what they're calling activism from the bench. Whether that is in place now or not is not really happening, because we're in unprecedented times, because the court has literally never been asked to rule on things like redistricting and abortion before. So it's going to feel unprecedented because it is unprecedented. But I mean, no judges were thrown off when you look at
the retentions
yeah. Right now. But I mean, there's some interesting minor data points with some judges getting close to 25% of people who responded said they should be thrown out. So,
well, Laura Scott, we should mention her voiding of Amendment A that at least got people talking. Sage, one of the things you've said is you've been seeing these conversations on social media about people who are like, let's just clean the slate of judges.
And I will say, I was looking at 2020 judicial retention results, and they're kind of the same. They're no votes or like no, like let's not retain them are up a tiny bit. A lot of them are hovering around, the 21% to 26%. And in 2020, there was around, it was like 13% to 20%. So it is a little bit up. And there have been a lot of talk on social media. And I will once again reiterate that social media is not, in fact, real life. But I do think it does sometimes give you a taste that there was a lot of people who wanted to cleanse the palate on the judicial bench, whether that be in the Utah Supreme Court or in a district court or the juvenile court. And there was even a lot more action on the JPEC website, which shows you the judicial reviews of all of these judges that are up for retention. Their site crashed a few times, so there was increased interest.
So what, people are filling out their ballots and like, what? Who is this person?
Correct.
Like where they wouldn't have necessarily in the past. You just flip a coin or just say,
Or like, okay, I mean, like, because like Utah's has had a pretty stellar nationally recognized judicial retention process. And it's been highly respected. And so I think people have kind of just trusted that. And I guess maybe there's a little bit lack of distrust now. I mean, maybe the margins are growing on that, but all the judges, they're fine. They're on the bench.
And I guess the one that I would note is Chief Justice Matthew Durant, who is probably the highest profile amid all of this stuff. He won with 78%, so most of them coasted. I agree with Sean. I think what's going to be interesting to watch is the – what the legislature tries to do to change the process. You know, talk of term limits, talk of additional retention hearings, things like that. There is a lot of outrage among the legislature toward the judges. Apparently, not reflected in the way the public voted on election day.
Anything to say about the judges part, Professor?
I think 70% approval is pretty high. What I think the legislature might want to do is what it already did when it made the state school board a partisan office. So I think their ultimate card to play would be to make judges partisan offices. And if Utah voters want to think about what that would be like, they just need to visit Ohio during the general election season. It's not a pretty picture if we make judicial elections partisan affairs. And I think it also has been a challenge and a disappointment, if you will, to have made the state school board partisan. Neither of those offices should be partisan.
Any sense of whether or not having amendments A and D both on the ballot but not worth anything, sort of having been voided out? This is something I think, Sean, you were wondering about, whether or not it helped or hurt, and who would it have helped and who would it have hurt? What do you make of all that?
I think with what we know right now, it's a big maybe. I think Amendment D more than Amendment A would have had a more a bigger impact on some of these races, particularly in the state legislature.
Will you just remind people what Amendment D is?
Yeah,
really quick.
Amendment D would have been a constitutional amendment that would have fundamentally changed the way ballot initiatives work in the state of Utah. It would have given the legislature carte blanche, essentially, to do whatever they want with any citizen-passed initiative. They could repeal, replace at their whim. And the Supreme Court said that, or at least the ballot language that was used to pose that to voters was misleading, and the votes should not count. So it was on ballots in many counties across the state, since I think every county had it on the ballot because yeah. Ballots had already been printed, but none of those votes were counted. I'm looking at the state elections website. There is no Amendment D box to even look at how many votes were cast there, and I think if it did have an impact, it would have seen that impact play out in those more competitive legislative races. But I will say there was some insulation to that. When you look at the vote breakdown of Amendment D at the legislature, almost every one of the legislators that is in a competitive seat either voted no on putting Amendment D on the ballot or did not cast a vote. So
they thought it mattered.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm skeptical that it had much of an impact. And again, like Sean said, we don't have the data yet that would, you know, back this up. But Representative Lou Bett was one that I was watching because he barely won his election 2 years ago. He voted against Amendment D. But if there's a backlash, there's a backlash. If it drives people who are angry to the polls, you're going to suffer those consequences regardless. And he won by more votes this time than he did 2 years ago. So I think the impact of those amendments probably was not as significant as we thought it might be. The court kind of threw them a lifeline in a way and spared them from this backlash because, you know, as we talked about on the show previously, the amendment process is supported by 90%+ of Utahns, according to all the polling that we've seen. The initiative process is supported by 90%+ of Utahns, and this cut across partisan divides had a real potential to be a firestorm that legislators brought on themselves, but they got bailed out.
We are about out of time. I'll just mention that it appears Jenny Wilson is going to win her bid for re-election. That seems quite clear in the Salt Lake County mayor's race. We can talk about the dynamics of county elections at another time. I want to ask you all finally, with the minute or so we have left, did anything change in Utah? And will something change as a result of all of this? Sean Higgins.
No. I don't think anything really changed. And I think if anything, we heard from Republicans everywhere last night that they have a new mandate. And I think we may see full steam ahead at the legislative level here in Utah, certainly full steam ahead at the federal level, whether it's pursuing more lawsuits against the federal government for control of public lands. That's the way I see it.
Sage.
Reiterate what Sean said. I agree with him 100%.
I think I'm watching the Zach Robinson, Dia Theodore race in Salt Lake County. That could change the makeup of the Salt Lake County Council. It's still about 1,600 votes right now. But aside from that, I think the only thing that changed is the neutering of the mainstream Republicans in the state is complete, because people like Mitt Romney, Spencer Cox are now falling. You fall in line with Trump or else you're out of the business.
David Magley, take 15 seconds and give us a final thought.
No change in Utah. Big changes nationally. If you're Mr. Zelensky today, you wake up very worried. If you're Benjamin Netanyahu, you're very happy. Taxes for affluent people will probably be cut again. And we're going to expand presidential powers thanks to this election.
David Magleby, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Brigham Young University. Sage Miller, KUER's politics and government reporter, co-host of State Street, along with Sean Higgins of KUER and Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Stevie Shaughnessy is our intern. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.